The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
The Chinese master Hong Zhu taught, study the Buddha and research his lineage's subtlety. You can then clarify your heart, dive into the spirit, and silently wander in contemplation, apprehending the Dharma's source. Without pettiness or weaving hairs to create an obstacle, be magnanimous beyond appearances, splendid and lustrous like the waters moistening autumn, noble like the moon overwhelming the darkness. From the beginning, just beam through all the gloom, profoundly free from stain. Before I get started, I just want to mention, whoever is doing the altars seems to be forgetting the haka box. It's quite full of day's ashes. Just a beam through all the gloom, profoundly free from stain. If we're not afraid to see, we are in a time of sadness and sorrow. Life as dukkha is abundantly clear. If we're awake, we see that we're in a time of great shift and possibility. Buddha nature pervades the whole universe. This too is abundantly clear. I wanted to talk a little bit about transmission lineage over the next few talks and using Master Huainong as an example. Usually when we think of transmission or speak of it, we're thinking of formal transmission when a student is empowered at the end of formal training. But there is transmission happening all the time. Otherwise, that formal transmission would not be possible. And I want to talk about this a little bit to sort of speak about why this is important. You know, I think what is happening in this country, in the West, with Buddhism, as it gets more settled, you know, we've really, in Buddhist geological time, Buddhism had only been in the West for a blink of an eye. But these days, things move very, very fast. So what would have taken decades, centuries, perhaps, in certain ways, is happening very, very quickly, which has some good aspects to it, but also some other aspects, because when things move more slowly, then other things are allowed to move along at the same time. It's like there's an evolution that's happening at different levels. And when certain things move very fast, other things don't, because they don't move at that speed. And I think one of the things that has always happened and is happening here is that as Buddhism becomes more of Buddhism, in the sense it becomes a tradition within a culture that is more accepted, more known, more practiced, more sort of infused into the culture, as centers develop, as in our day, scholars study it, historians do dissertations on it, so that Western Buddhism is a subject in and of itself. And so there's that sort of, what in many ways can be very helpful, that sort of outside perspective, looking at and looking through a scholar's lens, which is a very particular lens, and which can bring a lot of really interesting and important insight. But every action has a consequence. Everything that we do creates karma, creates ripples, like dropping a stone into a pond. And we may be looking in one direction because that's the direction we're interested in, or that's the direction where we see and recognize the consequence. But there are other directions that we don't see. And that's part of, I think, what happens when things move very fast. I mean, we could think of the whole state of our world in many ways as a response to certain things moving very, very fast without essential things like human beings growing up and being putting on their adult clothes and, you know, and understanding what the hell we're messing with. And what I think happens, is happening, and probably happened all the time throughout history, is as it gets looked at and through different lenses and discussed and written about in articles and now, you know, all of the different forms of media and sort of recording, all the different forms of recording, which again have their own value. But it affects, you know, so when we record something, we look at and are observing something, but in the very process of observing, that's changing things. And I was thinking about that with regards to the transmission of the Dharma, because that is something that you cannot measure. And it's really at the very heart of what we're doing here today, this week, this 40 years. To study the Buddha and research his lineage's subtlety. This study that Hongzhir speaks of, I think of as the direct transmission of Buddha Dharma. Not just from east to west, but from mind to mind. In a way that ultimately is not containable in words and phrases, in the sutras, in the meaning that's given to things, even in the teachings. This is what is attributed to Bodhidharma as a way of sort of describing the Zen tradition, a direct transmission, special transmission outside the scriptures, no reliance on words and letters. There's something going on, basically. There's something going on here. And as practitioners, we always have our own view of that. And that view is always embedded in the time that we're in our own journey, in our own path. It couldn't be otherwise. And there's accuracy in that. Right? There's truth in that, in the sense that there are certain things that we're discerning or recognize that are true. And there's also much that we're not seeing. Because that's just the nature of it. And that becomes revealed over time. That's the nature of it. That's why it's important to stick around, to keep showing up. This research, the research is lineage of subtlety, he's not, I don't think, talking about an historical accounting, but rather a leaping into the enlightened mind, seeing Buddha. Study the Buddha and research his lineage's subtlety. How do we research it? So a scholar researches it as a scholar. But how does a practitioner study the Buddha? To study and directly realize our lineage's subtlety. The Buddha said this Dharma, after his own realization, said this Dharma is subtle and profound, difficult to see. Now think of what he meant by that, which we can only imagine, and poorly, I would think. Think from his view, from the depth of his understanding, his enlightenment, what he was seeing when he said that. And so I think of this study as taking place within our zazen. fundamentally. There is something that happens when we sit in the posture of the Buddha, in the posture of a mountain, and discover the depths, the profound and subtle nature of what we call stillness and what we call silence. But these words are so pale to try and describe that, those truths within us. I think of it as stepping forward, reaching the top of the mountain and stepping forward, this study of the Buddha. We can think of it as home leaving, leaving all that we hold dear, all that we cherish, all that we're enchanted by. Beginning with mountains and mountains, rivers are rivers, then realizing, no, they're not. No, they're not. As the Buddha said, things are not as they seem. But then eventually returning to that place that we've never left, mountains are mountains, rivers are rivers. The Buddha said, nor are they otherwise. And so now finally we can really use the things of the world, all of them, internal, external, material, non-material, what we call real, what we know is imagined. But now we can use them without deception and use them to serve, to benefit. To study the Buddha and research the lineages, this moment, free of past, present, and future, but it contains all time. It's sitting here together, mutually polishing the ancient mirror. I've been thinking about this a lot during this time when we are separated, many of us, by the distance between this home and your home, and the wonder and the benefit and the great fortune of being able to do this via the internet. And which has been really interesting to, in the process of doing that, to see, you know, what does that enable us to do? What does that bring forth? Because of that medium, this medium that we have, and what can it not bring forth? What can it not provide or replace that only happens when we are actually in the same physical space? And as time goes on, I feel more and more, it seems more and more clear how essential that is. That there are things that take place when we are in the presence of each other that don't happen otherwise. They have to do with our physical bodies being in the same physical space. Master Dogen spoke of practicing with the whole body and mind. He also spoke of all-inclusive practice. And he said to study by doing, to do all-inclusive practice is to study by doing cartwheels. I wonder what that translation is. I guess it's a cartwheel. Maybe there are cartwheels all over the world. Can you imagine Dogen doing a cartwheel? To study by doing cartwheels. He said, sacred truths don't do anything. What degrees could there be in such truths? And so this transmission is and has been and must be person to person, Buddha to Buddha, mind to mind. It has always been this way. Maybe it's only my limited imagination, but I can only think it must always be this way. And so for us, this began with the Buddha, a person in real time, real place, with his own journey, his own path, his own enlightenment, his own teaching, which is now manifesting here. So the Buddha is transmitting the Dharma now, here, to this time and place. And so historians and scholars look at the history and say, well, has it been a continuous person-to-person, Buddha-to-Buddha transmission? Have there been gaps within lineages? Was each teacher who transmitted to their disciple deeply enlightened? Was each disciple who received the transmission deeply enlightened? Did each transmission have complete integrity? Did each teacher teach with complete integrity? Well, we're dealing with human beings. And so we know that human life and human history comes with gaps and failings. And in each generation, Buddha mind has been discovered. Again, for the first time. That's what transmission is. In each person, discovering the mind of the Buddha again for the first time. And that which is transmitted ultimately is not in the teachings, and we say that, and of course in our tradition, that's part of our sort of self-framing, self-defining, the Zen tradition. It's not in the sutras. It's not in the teacher. Though all of these have an essential role. You know, and just how the dualistic mind can say, well, if they're not essential, that means they are not important. Which is not true at all. What is transmitted is what is alive and awakened and discovered and actualized within you. This is how we can sit here today. This is how we are sitting here today. We are sitting in the midst of it. We are filled with it. Shanti Davis said that this most pure and spotless state of mind should be embraced and constantly increased, developed. The prudent who have cultivated it should praise it highly. Those of us who are fortunate to have encountered the Dharma and are here cultivating it, to be so fortunate, should praise it highly in such words as these. Today my life has given fruit. This human state has now been well assumed. Today I take my place in Buddha's line, the lineage, and have become the Buddha's child and heir. And so for centuries, practitioners, young and old, are often referred to as the children of the Buddha. In every way that I will undertake activities befitting such a place that I have so fortunately found myself in. And I will endeavor to do no act to mar or compromise this lineage, this transmission, this order, this sangha, this vessel, this life. Because it's like as though I have been a blind person who finally found a precious gem within a mound of filth. And as if by some strange chance, bodhicitta has arisen within me. And so scholars have looked at lineages and seen gaps and irregularities. And within our own tradition, there was a teacher, a Soto master, whose heirs all died before him, right? And so he had no one to transmit to, but he had a very close friend who was in a different lineage altogether, but who he felt intimately understood his teachings. And so he transmitted to this person. And throughout history, there have been, in the transmission of the light, clearly says in the introduction that the whole issue of transmission and succession has a checkered history. He said the very idea of it implies that there's something that is passed on, right? Something that the teacher gives the student. which of course is not the nature of this, because each of us comes with the whole. You said communication of Zen or what is transmitted is instead defined in terms of mutual recognition of awakened minds. That's accurate. An old master, Fayan, said when the founder of Zen came from India to China, Bodhidharma, it was not because there was something to transmit. He just pointed directly to people's minds so they could see their essential nature and realize enlightenment. How could there be any sectarian differences to argue about? And he says that because throughout the history of Buddhism, there's been lots of sectarian arguments. Within lineages, across lineages, within traditions, across traditions. Who's got the best? Who knows the most? Dogen has a fascicle where he said, you know, the Buddha never talked about Zen. He taught Dharma. And so let's not get too caught up in anything, but in particular, those upaya that we use within our tradition, lest they become exactly like everything else in samsara. Things to argue about, things to have conflict over, things to create suffering, which is never their purpose. He talks about how, he says in the early Zen masters of China, all through up to about the 10th century, rarely even mentioned Zen successorship, much less make any claim to authority thereby. It's very interesting. Those of you who did the retreat with Pema Khandro Rinpoche, she talked about, you know, the importance of recognizing her teachers, her lineage, which is what really important and profound and beautiful and respectful. It's recognizing how we have come here today. Who do we owe our debt to, and who, in a sense, is the source of our own teaching. So the teacher's role is not to make something up anew, but really just to express what has already been expressed 100,000 billion times. Shanti Deva says, at the beginning of his Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life, he says, I'm not saying anything new here. All of this has been said before. And so there's that recognition, right? And within that, a humility, right? As well as an empowerment, an authority, and a responsibility. And then to sort of, as he talks about it, and, you know, sort of it'd been my experience, is that within the Zen tradition, that's not really, you know, in other traditions, there really is a tradition of and a practice of the teacher as a guru. You know, that is really worked with in meditation and in very, you know, reverential ways, very actively. And in the Zen tradition, that's not so much the case. I imagine that even if Dada Roshi woke up, reassembled his skandhas and walked into the Dokusan room and saw that my picture of him on my altar, he would... And he says something that I wasn't aware of. I had to go look again, that Chuching, Dogen's teacher, throughout the whole of his life, and he was a very, very well-regarded teacher, highly respected, that he never revealed his succession until the day he died. Even though he held very prominent positions in very significant monasteries. And his wisdom, his mastery, was never in doubt. And so it's said in Zen, good children don't use their parents' money. So there's a very different perspective, right? One is, you know, I'm borrowing my parents' money for a little bit, and I'm going to offer some to you. And another perspective is, no, I'm not going to use my parents' money. But in both cases, the living stream is present and alive. The intimate connection going all the way back, the gratitude and obligation is very much alive. That's not different. Dogen, in his fascicle on face-to-face transmission, Menju, said, "Once on Vulture Peak in India, in the midst of a vast assembly of beings, Shakyamuni Buddha held up an Udumbara flower and winked. Mahakashyapa smiled. And Shakyamuni Buddha said, 'I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the wondrous heart of Nirvana. I entrust it now to Mahakashyapa.'" So in the Zen tradition, this is held up as the first transmission of the Dharma, the first formal empowerment to the next generation, which is ahistorical. It could have happened, right? But scholars outside of the Zen tradition speak of this event. The Udumbara flower is a flower that is supposed to bloom every 3,000 years, and I was trying to see if there's any, you know, information about it. It's an actual flower. And I read a short piece by a botanist, I think, who said, when it comes to the idea of the Udumbara, you really have to wonder what kind of reality some people exist in. For starters, now this is an actual flower. For starters, Udumbara is said to only bloom once every 3,000 years. Oh, really? Who keeps track of such events? Evolutionarily speaking, what could possibly be the benefit to a strategy like this? So it's kind of a nice example, a simple example, of the difference between fact, or Karen Armstrong speaks of as logos, that which is of our rational mind, like what's true, what can be verified, right? What do we have proof of? And mythos, that is, the mystic path. What has meaning, and in that meaning, imparts something to us, gives us something, empowers us, inspires us, motivates us, helps us to open up our minds and see something in a larger way, to imagine that the world is larger than what can be measured. And so whether this first transmission actually happened, from the point of view of practice, is immaterial. It's not the point. The point is the Buddha held up a flower and Mahakashyapa smiled. And the Buddha recognized that and said, "I entrust you with the treasury of the true Dharma eye." And so the student is left with, what did Mahakashyapa see? That's the point of the dialogue. To invite us in to a living inquiry. That's the transmission. That's the Dharma being transmitted. It is face to face. I appreciate that this was translated, and it is face to face. We often speak of it as mind to mind, but this is face to face. And that both brings with it the physical reality of sitting face to face as we do. You know, in our tradition, that is a very significant part of our training, which is not the case in all other traditions. In a sense, it's very intensive work, both on the part of the teacher and the student. It's very demanding. I remember being at a retreat, a Tibetan teacher years ago, and the whole retreat was a series of teachings. And during questions and answer, students were asking questions. Some of these students had been with this teacher for a long time. And as I was listening to the questions, I realized, oh, these are the questions they're asking because they don't get face-to-face teaching. Or this is how they are getting that, but they're getting it within a group, which has its own value, but is also quite, quite, quite different. I remember, again, thinking of the fact that we are in these physical bodies, and we can think of that as just like, well, yeah, I'm in this physical body. So what? And I'm sitting in front of you because I have a question, and I hope the teacher responds to my question. So there's something happening on that level. What else is happening, though? Our senses are alive, and one of our senses is our mind. And they're always receiving. We're not always cognizant of what's being received. But that doesn't mean that they're not receiving. In a sense, it's a good thing that we're not cognizant of everything we're receiving because we get overloaded with information, right? And so our brains are brilliant at sort of, you know, managing all of that. But something is being experienced. I remember before I lived here, and I would come up every Sunday for services, and I would come here for 3 hours, and I could sort of record, okay, we did service, and then we sat, and then I listened to a talk, and then I had some spaghetti, right? And then I went home. And often on the ride back, I would think that would be on one side of the scale, right? Okay, I sat and, you know, did liturgy and did talk and spaghetti. And on the other side was what I felt. And they didn't make sense. What I was experiencing, what I felt like I was leaving with, was I couldn't put together with those parts. Entrusting the true Dharma eye to the true Dharma eye. That the teachings are always speaking to us as Buddhas, as possessing enlightened mind, with the confidence that we can enlighten that enlightened mind. And so when we don't understand the teachings, as I've said often before, it's because they're speaking to that aspect of our mind. And so we have to keep learning how to shift, how to open, how to hear, and simultaneously be able to understand and not know at the same time. Dogen says, this is the meaning of transmitting the treasury of the true Dharma eye face to face, from Buddha to Buddha, from ancestor to ancestor, holding up the flower. And so we have to learn the unspoken language of the flower, which is not anything we might imagine. It's not the language of a botanist or a naturalist or a lover of flowers or an artist, although all of those languages are wonderful too. The Buddha sees Mahakaishapa, Dogen said. Our eyes open and we look and we take in the form of each other. Our eyes do see, but what does our mind see? And our eyes are designed, brilliant as they are, to see within a certain spectrum, right? Not just of, you know, light, but of tangibility. And so how fortunate it is that the eye is not just an organ, right? Just a ball of jelly that sees, but it is consciousness. There is eye consciousness. and that what is we call mind consciousness is what actually receives the full message beyond just what the eye itself can see as an organ. Sitting face to face, studying face to face. We think of as students, we want to get to know the teacher, that we want the teacher to get to know us. And so there is an aspect of training that is about that. From the point of view of your practice and your liberation, it's not just to develop familiarity, to share stories. It is all about what is needed on the path of awakening. Trust, confidence, openness, relaxation, vulnerability, to let the walls come down. So that more and more the student and teacher can meet on the ground of reality. The Buddha saw Mahakashyapa. And that ground of reality is the place of the great matter. So more and more the student and teacher meet in the place that is most essential. To get there, we have to work with all of those things in the mind of the student that now seem most essential. Right? Because if we don't do that, they will block us. They will prevent us. And through the transmission is to transform those things, which at this moment might seem like, you know, the largest things in the universe, transform them into the great matter. And over time to realize, yes, those were important, yes, those were significant, but they were not the importance that I was giving to them. Which, remember, dualistic mind, that doesn't mean they are not important. See how fast the mind switches. You know, if it's not this, then it has to be this. If it's not the most important thing, that means it's unimportant and I should ignore it. Or you're disregarding some aspect of myself. That's not the case. And so there's Dokusan, there's Taisho, there's Daisan, there's Mondos, there are meals we have together where we talk about simple things, sometimes very significant things. There are meals we have where we don't talk at all, not in words. We share the space in silence and in speech, in somberness, and full of intent and in lightness and buoyancy. We work together, we live together. There's body teaching. There are moments where we have an encounter and we know we have received something. We know something has entered through the gate. But so, so many more times we don't know that. You know, it's kind of like when you're on a trip in a new land, and there's so many things you have to, you know, where you're going to sleep tonight, and how do you translate, you know, communicate in a new language, and how do you get your money changed, and, you know, what kind of food is this, and all of these details, right? And then later, at different moments, sometimes after the trip, you're already home again, it's like you look back and you realize how much was happening, all that you were experiencing. How you were being changed, impacted. Words are spoken, questions are asked, and all for the purpose of shaking free of form and sound, personalities and histories. And so it takes a little bit of time. As the Kiwis would say, it takes a wee bit of time. A lifetime. And at each step, each meeting, if the conditions are right, are shaking the rafters crumbling the mountains of its accumulation, letting the wind and the clouds and the sunlight move freely. Dogen says, the world honored one and Mai Kashyapa sat together on the same seat and wore the same robe. And thus he received the world honored one's transmission directly, face to face, mind to mind, body to body, eye to eye. And the transmission, the actual ceremony reenacts that in different ways. When the chief disciple sits next to the teacher leading the Ango, that is a reenactment of that. Sharing the same seat. But those moments are just moments that are held up, sort of formal moments, but it's happening all the time. And Dogen says it's all for one purpose. Thousands of times Mai Kashyapa had pounded his bones and crushed his body. His face was no longer his own, and thus he received the Buddha's face through face-to-face transmission. And so we sit together in this hall of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, this hall of mind training. Sometimes when, it doesn't really happen here, but when I was at the temple for those years, sometimes people would come in and just want to do the whatever they wanted to do. And I would say, you know, this isn't a meditation this isn't just a meditation hall. It's a training hall. There's a difference, right? One is it's just a space where people can come in and do meditation, right? The other is a place of training in which what we call meditation and what we mean by meditation is taken up in addition to worlds of other practices. And so all of that is not simply, and what happens in face-to-face is not just Zazen instruction, it's not just receiving guidance, and it's not just addressing whatever's coming up, it's not getting support, it is all of those, but it is not just that. There is something happening that cannot be expressed, that cannot be measured, that oftentimes goes unnoticed, but is felt, perceived, and at different points along the way, subtly answered. It is an aspect of pounding our bones and crushing our body, which is a dramatic way. Don't do this at home, right? Of forgetting the self, right? Pounding the bones, crushing the body, releasing, relinquishing, freely giving up that which we hold most dear. So that we can use all that we hold dear now, freely, without it entangling us, without us entangling others, so that we can see that my face is no longer my own. Your face is no longer your own. Now we can meet. Pounding the bones and crushing the body is really so that we can become soft and pliant. It's like kneading dough. Dogen says, day and night, Mai Kashyapa closely attended Shakyamuni Buddha and spent his whole Dharma life intimately illuminated by the Buddha's face. He's not talking about this. How long, Dogen says, how long has this been happening is beyond comprehension, beyond our imagination. Quietly and joyously reflect on this. How long has this been happening? It's beyond our capacity to even wonder. Quietly and joyously reflect on this. I spoke this morning about how this path is difficult. It is. And sometimes people, students will ask, why is it made so difficult? Why do we make it so difficult? It is not set up for the purpose of being difficult. It is set up for the purpose of being rigorous. Rigorous in the sense that if you want to do something that is in which people's lives depend on, like if you're going to a doctor, don't you want to make sure her training has been rigorous? Or a nurse? Or an airline pilot? Or president? Or a parent? Is that too much to ask? When your life depends on it? That's what it is set up. That's what it is. It's set up to be rigorous so that we can, with that degree of meticulousness and sustained effort, meet the Buddha. See the Buddha's face. Realize our face is not our own. Hallelujah. Finally, we can be free of the weight of that ownership. And so Dogen says, this is a splendid opportunity for Buddha Dharma to freshly enter into mud and water, the mud and water of your mind and body. If you do not realize the fruit at this moment, when will you realize it? If you don't dissolve and realize, illuminate your delusion at this moment, when will you illuminate it? If you do not become a Buddha at this moment, when will you? When will you practice as an active Buddha? Diligently examine this. And I think he's asking these questions so directly as a way of saying, do not be afraid to enter into the mud and water. Do not be afraid to give up the ownership of your face, to see into your body and mind, to free yourself of what binds you. Quietly and joyously reflect on this. The fact that such rigorous and intense and sometimes, yes, difficult, painful practice and work can bring forth such joy should make us curious. What's going on? I'll leave that for you to answer.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma Talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.